You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
This terrorist attack by a known criminal, a man who was only recently released on parole, is a shocking, cowardly crime.
Authorities in Melbourne and in London realise that there's something familiar about the names of terrorists. When is it not enough to put someone on a watch list? My guests Daniela Pellad and John Everard will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the sudden isolation of Qatar, a row into which Donald Trump has now waded, which does not appear to be helping, a new front in the war against Islamic State in the Philippines, and why is Israel playing along with Russia's weird ideas about same-sex couples adopting. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are John Everard, formerly British Ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and Daniela Pellad, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, contributor to Haaretz, among others. Welcome both. Now, not that it was a lesson that should require reinforcement, but recent events in London and Melbourne have demonstrated one of the crucial difficulties of interdicting terrorism. Of the trio who attacked London Bridge on Saturday, we have learned that at least two were known to authorities. One, indeed, was known to viewers of Channel 4, on which Kuram Butt had appeared in a documentary about British jihadis. More or less the same is true of Jacob Khairy, who was shot dead by Australian police on Monday after taking a hostage and pledging allegiance to Islamic State. He had a lengthy criminal history and was free on parole. Daniela, first of all, the fact that they were, as the phrase goes, known to police, has prompted a certain amount of spluttering outrage from the more excitable reaches of the media in Britain and Australia. But is that anger unreasonable? Should these people have been free?
Well, I think in the case of the chap in the Channel 4 documentary, it's extremely embarrassing because that's really a very... an announcement to the world. I mean, perhaps he came across as something of a cartoon figure, but that's embarrassing. It's true that the intelligence and security services have to be wrong once, and you don't count how many times they get it right. The problem is, though, when something like this happens, people start jumping up and down saying something must be done, and something must be done is often really quite dangerous. We don't need more legislation. We have quite significant measures in place. The idea that we're going to lock up people who seem suspicious—it's apart from ethical issues, it's not practical. Round-the-clock surveillance is immensely expensive and can't be used in every case. So, when people say something must be done, it's kind of hard to articulate exactly what they suggest.
John, do police maybe need to err slightly more on the side of caution when making that distinction? And it is a dreadfully difficult distinction to make. The case, you know, that Daniela mentions there of Kuram Butt, who had appeared in a documentary proclaiming his jihadist inclinations, could well lead one to assume that he was a time-wasting blowhard. Similarly, Omar Mateen, who shot up the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, was forever being reported to police by workmates for proclaiming his allegiance to Hamas or Hezbollah or whatever had drifted across his consciousness that day. How difficult is it to make that judgment between somebody who is a genuine threat and somebody who is just an attention-seeking irritant?
It's extremely difficult. Just because you're an idiot doesn't mean that you're not necessarily a terrorist as well. And I think
the Venn diagram does overlap quite significantly, I think.
Yes, I think a lot of people would agree with that. And I think the police, too, would love to agree that they should err on the side of caution. It all comes down to money. To mount 24-hour surveillance, it's hideously expensive, Danny has just pointed out. You need about two dozen people to do a proper watch on people. And the security service doesn't have that kind of manpower. It does have lamplighter teams going around doing this, but money is short, time is short, and they can't do it for everybody. Essentially, they do it for people they believe are in the final stages of preparing an attack. And can we please not forget that we've had three attacks since March, but somebody senior, I think it's Jonathan Friedland, let slip they've stopped five.
So Theresa May, in fact.
Oh, she said that too.
She said that they five plausible plots.
There we go. Endorsement from the highest level. Mm. So the tactics do work. It's just that there aren't enough of them, and it'll be interesting to see whether this great sort of thumping of drums to go and do something actually turns out into more resources for the security service to pay for more teams to try to catch people like Butt before they start drawing their knives.
I believe in Britain there's something around 3,000 people on a watch list. Now, the thought of locking up those 3,000 people is indefensible. Not just about resources. There's also the question of civil liberties, and also the question of how it would serve to absolutely hugely stoke racial and religious tensions if we do that, and how it will fuel. It can't but fuel extremism if you start having locking up masses of people before they've committed crimes.
That is true. I cannot think off the top of my head of an example in which large-scale internment of suspect people or suspect populations has not made a bad situation worse. But John, as Daniela said, we already have lots of laws on the books about terrorism and associated offences, whether it's hate speech, incitement, etc., etc. Do those laws need to be maybe prosecuted more rigorously? And should sentences be longer when convictions are made?
I don't think the problem is so much in the level and intensity of prosecutions. I think it is simply in the lack of resources for implementing the existing legislation. Lack of money for the police, lack of money for the security service, lack of bodies, lack of experts. This is a cash problem, not a big political problem.
Daniela, we also heard the Prime Minister talking, I think on Sunday it would have been, about internet companies and internet providers needing to do more. Is there a case that social media outlets in particular need to be treated under law, not merely as disseminators of information, but actually as publishers and held to the same standards that any print outlet would be? I mean, if you know, any newspaper started, print advertising revenues are drying up, but I can't imagine anyone's getting this desperate. But if a newspaper did start running full-page glossy advertisements for Islamic State, they'd get into fairly serious trouble, wouldn't they?
Yeah, there is an argument to be made for social media outlets being treated as responsible media organisations. But it's a troubling one, and it's a difficult one. And it's not just about support for terrorism and extremist views, but also about fake news. And that Facebook, etc., have vowed to try and take steps to highlight this. And the whole illogicality of the spread of information on social media is highlighted by things like what Facebook considers extremist content. The whole furore about Facebook removing pictures of women breastfeeding, whereas it will allow all kinds of other hogwash on it. So I mean, this is a conversation that will have to be had and people are having. But I think Mrs. May is a little bit opportunist tick on this, since he was, after all, Home Secretary for 6 years and oversaw public security. And this reflects rather badly on her, really. So she's saying, yes, enough is enough. Something must be done. She's falling victim to exactly the something must be done-ism, which is just what we don't want.
John, final thought on this. The something must be done tendency does tend to prompt that, I think, as once codified by Yes Minister, something must be done, this is something, therefore we must do it. Among the somethings that have been done since Saturday night is that we're seeing more police on the streets and barriers put on bridges across the Thames. Do things like that actually make a difference, or is there an element of theatre about them? And in fairness, is the element of theatre actually important? Is the cosmetic reassurance actually useful?
Yes, I was just about to make that point. Cosmetic reassurance of any kind is useful. People are understandably concerned about what happened, and visible demonstrations that somebody somewhere is doing something are important. Daniel is right. I mean, this shouldn't cause us to start jumping and doing really silly things, but putting up physical things in streets probably isn't isn't going to hurt anybody, and it looks good, and it probably makes people feel a bit safer. Whether these will actually stop terrorist attacks, don't know. I mean, presumably, it's a little more difficult to drive your hard white van through over a bridge if there are barriers across it. But maybe this will simply cause the terrorists to find new and interesting ways of conducting attacks without vans. Let's see.
I'm sure you're right. But also, I mean, it might sound silly, but we have these barriers. I think it's also very important to make them look good and let they fit into our urban landscape rather than just big concrete blocks. I think we need to think of creative ways in which you can form physical barriers without looking and feeling like we're under siege. And more police on the streets will make people feel reassured. Armed police, not so much.
Okay, well, let's look now at Qatar. The Persian Gulf promontory has found itself abruptly unfriended by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Yemen, the Maldives, and at least one of Libya's governments. Qatar stands accused of supporting terrorism, and while the record of certain of the accusers invites no end of metaphors involving glass houses, thin ice, and charred cookware, the consequences are serious. Qatar's transport links with much of the world have been more or less severed. Daniela, first of all, what is actually going on here, do we think? Why has everybody very, very suddenly got upset with Qatar and decided to make a thing of it?
Well, this has been going on for a while, and there was a previous spat in 2014, it wasn't as serious, but it led to all kinds of threats.
This is beyond spat. I think we're into the realms of brouhaha.
Quite exactly. After a few months in 2014, everyone was agreed to step back, and there were some concessions made. But to put it bluntly, Qatar is not acting in concert with the rest of its Gulf allies, the rest of the GCC. It is following a policy of being friends with all kinds of people. So hosting Hamas, but also having ties to Israel, being quite friendly with Iran, but also, you know, being a Sunni Arab state, and Saudi Arabia and others are having no more of it and seem to feel emboldened by Trump's visit a couple of weeks ago. And they're saying, right, you have to stop your wayward ways. Now, the measures they've taken are pretty severe and may have the actual effect of driving Qatar quite the reverse, you know, breaking up the GCC. Maybe that's, you know, one rather troubling possibility. There's not much room to manoeuvre because the sort of concessions they're asking from Qatar, I can't quite see them conceding, you know, anytime soon.
John, is this the Arab world telling Qatar to pick a side?
Yes, and it's more than that. It's telling Qatar to pick Saudi Arabia's side. I mean, the points of the GCC are very simple. Complete freedom of opinion. Everybody is entitled to Saudi Arabia's opinion. And the fact that Qatar has come out and thought differently is severe lèse majesté. This is all about links with Iran and supporting other terrorist groups. Not that Saudi Arabia ever does that itself. No. Perish the thought. But more, it's simply sort of lack of deference to Riyadh. And it's against the background, of course, of this constant rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I think if the country in question with which Qatar had had links had been anyone other than Iran, the Saudi reaction would have been much less vituperative. But the Iranian link, they really, really couldn't stomach.
Daniela, US President Donald Trump, curiously, is now claiming credit for this isolation of Qatar by its neighbours and some non-neighbours, which is strange for many reasons, but not least that Qatar does actually host the United States' biggest military base in the Middle East at Uladeid Airfield.
Exactly. I think 11,000 troops, something like that. I mean, we're not expecting consistency from the American president here. And it's frankly impossible to understand his motivations for this. The easiest thing I can think of, and the most simplistic explanation, is that he's making this very sharp pivot away from Obama, who wanted to include Iran in a peace process, and, you know, as a not an ally, but, you know, to shift this from this very binary Sunni Shia divide. Whereas Trump seems to think that he's going to have this great Sunni alliance without realizing that actually it's not necessarily quite so moderate, and there are all kinds of extremist groups allied and involved in this. I mean, it's another bonkers move. What can I say?
John, what kind of options does Qatar now have in terms of both concessions that they might be grudgingly willing to make or means of upping the ante, say, for example, deciding to send home 350,000 Egyptian workers?
Yes, essentially, it either Qatar caves quickly and gracefully, as far as you can cave gracefully in this kind of situation, or Qatar hangs tough and risks economic devastation. I mean, Qatar imports almost all its food, 40% of it from Saudi Arabia, which is not coming in right now. We've already seen stockpiling in supermarkets and supermarket shelves being emptied. But, you know, that could be got around. Food could be shipped in.
Iran could very happily ship in quite a lot of food.
Yes, that's right. It could. And as Daniel was saying earlier, the other risk that what Saudi's doing, what the GCC is doing, is going to push Qatar into exactly the opposite direction, putting two fingers up to Riyadh and saying, you know, if you want to play it this way, you know, we realise now who our friends are. Significant, notice that Saudi did not manage to get the entire GCC behind it. Kuwait and Oman have not signed up, which must rankle rather.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think I suspect that's, you know, like you have a fight in a pub and there's always one person that hangs back a bit because they're going to go in and say, like, pull the two parties apart. You know, I think Kuwait is quite good at taking that peacemaker role and has already stepped up and offered to host dialogue. I mean, I think the consequences of this are so grave that I'm not wondering if both sides have not, you know, prepared a ladder to climb down, so to speak.
Don't bank on it. I mean, I think this was assuming that, okay, these tensions have been brewing for a very long time, precipitated in the immediate past by President Trump's massively misguided speech, as we were just saying. They probably haven't had a lot of time to prepare this. I suspect they just pulled triggers and haven't thought through the consequences. I don't think anybody got ladders right now.
Daniela, you talk about the potentially serious consequences. How serious? If, for example, that Qatar does decide that its friends actually are in Tehran, does that unhelpfully paint or unhelpfully sort of apportion the Gulf region into two extremely hostile camps?
Yeah, I mean, things are not exactly stable there at the moment, and President Trump is not helping, really. If you have
a fairly evergreen observation.
Yes,
at the moment.
I know. It's a wonderfully British understatement, I imagine. But if you divide, if you're going to simplistically divide the region into two camps, Shia bad, Sunni good, it's a completely unhelpful way of looking at it. I mean, I think Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are of the same view on this. They see that the moderate Sunni states as their allies, and see Iran as the major risk. Now, you start driving the likes of Qatar firmly into the Iranian camp, that's very troubling. But, you know, the economic consequences in the short term and the medium term are also pretty immense, not just regionally, but also Qatar owns an awful lot of property here, for instance. You know, that's going to have some effect.
And it's going to have some kind of effect on OPEC too. I mean, if Qatar feels it's being excluded and breaks away, Qatar's reserves by themselves are not going to make a huge difference. But in an organisation that's having great trouble holding itself together in any case, that kind of momentum could get dangerous.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Daniela Pellad and John Everard. Coming up next, the Philippines, to which we should probably all have been paying more attention.
Who can say where the world's headed? Well, with Monocle's transport-themed June issue in tow, you'll reach your destination enlivened and entertained, and with a good read on where things are heading. We stop off in Van, a Turkish city with a Persian pull that's luring fun-loving Iranians across the border. We meet Munich's fast-moving mobility players, get in gear with the finest bike retailers, and work up a sweat at Techno Gym's Toothsome HQ in Emilia Romagna in Italy. We're also on set in New York, in Hamburg for the annual Aircraft Interiors Expo, and in Albania for the Prime Minister's fictional final feast. All that, plus Oslo's fashion startups, the small-scale supermarkets with big ideas, and a peek at London's most ambitious new hospitality venture. So strap in. Monocle's high-octane transport issue is on newsstands now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
You You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniela Pellard and John Everard. And let's look now at the Philippines, most of whose recent ventures into the headlines have been a consequence of the intemperance of its president, Rodrigo Duterte, who appears to have learned much of what he understands of politics from the films of Sam Peckinpah. Under the radar, however, a reasonably serious war has erupted on the island of Mindanao, where the city of Marawi has become a battlefield between the Philippines military and what appears to be the local franchise of Islamic State. At least 170 people are known to have died, and more than 180,000 people have fled the city. John, is this a Southeast Asian Mosul? I'm rather reminded of that sort of worldwide bewilderment when everybody woke up and realized that these people had meandered in from the desert and conquered a city the size of Birmingham.
It was nearly a Filipino Mosul. I think the plan was for a quick, swift strike, surgical, to take Marawi before the world, and particularly before the Filipino government, realized what was happening. Of course, it went badly wrong. The Filipino army had a tip-off that one of the kingpins of Abu Sayyaf and of the Dawdy Brothers organization was going to be in Marawi, moved in, and discovered that they were in the process of taking over the city. From the insurgents' point of view, suddenly discovering that you have got several units of the Filipino army sitting on your doorstep was no part of their plan. What was supposed to be a quick, dramatic takeover of a city is turning into a bloody, messy and drawn-out siege, which neither side want, least of all Abu Sayyaf, who seem to be losing hundreds of precious fighters. They can't really afford the manpower, and things are not going well for them.
Daniela, it's a question that tends to attend now almost every incidence of terrorism, from something of this scale to something of the rather smaller scale that we've seen recently in London and in Melbourne, and today by some reports out of Paris. But there's always the question of what influence Islamic State are having on affairs. Do we assume that these people in the Philippines who are declaring allegiance to the Islamic State have signed up to it as a formal entity, or is it now just a vague idea that is, whatever you're having yourself?
Well, I mean, there's been an ongoing Islamist insurgency in the area for decades.
This
now.
Is true.
I have yet to see any firm evidence of a sort of command or control structures between Islamic states in Syria or Iraq and the Philippines, although their connections with groups in Sinai may be a bit stronger. But I think it is. They see, the idea, you see a brand, you sign up to it. And, it does work quite successfully, I think, as a recruiting tool and also to frighten the government. And I think one of the big dangers here is the government response. I mean, we have a project in the Philippines. I've been talking to people on the ground there, and they're frightened. Martial law being declared. I mean, Duterte has made it very clear that he's announced it for 60 days, and he says he might extend it longer, he might extend it to the rest of the country. Well, the Philippines has been there before when it comes to martial law, and he has not exactly been delighting people with his human rights record. So I think there's a double danger here, really. There's the Islamist insurgency, and there's what the actions the state is taking to crack down on it.
That's right. And not just has he announced it, but he's announced it across the whole of Mindanao, not just in Marawi, which caused a few jaws to drop when the president went live to say all this. Talk about taking a sledgehammer to crack a nut. Duterte, even under civilian government, has shown himself quite ready to frankly break the law, just tell his thugs to go on the street and shoot people. What he might do under military, under martial law, doesn't been thinking about.
John, in the case of Mosul, we did see a huge multinational effort, a raid to attempt to restore it to Iraq. Is it possible that the very fact of Rodrigo Duterte's presidency will make it less likely that other countries might be inclined to help the Philippines?
Yes, I think that is likely. And in any case, it seems fairly clear that barring a miracle or a disaster, depending on your point of view, the Filipino army is going to recapture Marawi. They vastly outnumber the insurgents. The insurgents have got stockpiles buried in tunnels and in cellars around the city, we now learn, but they're not likely to be that large. And they can probably eventually be starved out. This is going to be messy. A lot of people are going to get hurt, but I don't think there's any real doubt about who's going to win.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we will look at a non-heartwarming display of international cooperation. Israel has promised Russia that same-sex Israeli couples will not be permitted to adopt Russian children. Russia is the principal destination for Israelis seeking to adopt, but is not known for its progressive attitude to same-sex relationships, in much the same way that the Netherlands is not regarded as one of the world's great mountaineering destinations. Daniela, why is Israel going along with this?
Well, Israel has always had a very dysfunctional relationship with Russia. Russia is good chums with some of its avowed enemies, for instance, sticking up for Hamas and being a long-time ally of Syria, even before the current civil war. And yet there are very close ties between Russia and Israel. There's 1.5 million Russian citizens living in Israel, strong economic and so on, links. So Israel needs Russia. Russia's not necessarily that bothered about needing Israel. So Israel has had to go along with it. There aren't that many places that Israelis can adopt children for. Russian, I think, has been the only
It's the most popular in some years. Yes, it has been literally the only country
for the last couple of years, and Israel has got in some aspects a very good record on LGBT rights, but it's also quite happy to use that for political purposes, and in this case, to lay down the rainbow banner when it suits its international relations.
We should note, indeed, that it is Pride Week in Tel Aviv this week, which I suspect is a rather quieter occasion in Moscow. John, what strikes me, well, many things strike me about this, but if you look at Russia's edict in itself that it will not permit the adoption of its children by same-sex couples, if any country issued an instruction like that about any other minority, they would be more or less instant pariahs, wouldn't they?
Do you think Putin would notice? I think, yes, I mean, of course you're right, but Russia just doesn't see the world in those terms. I mean, these the Russians will say they are sticking up for basic Russian values, which do not include what we describe here as LGBT rights. And they are not going to allow good Russian children to be taken into sort of wicked families where terrible, terrible sort of practices are performed. In the end, as is clear from the figures, this is a supplier's market. If you are the country that is putting children up for adoption, you can just about dictate the terms. And the Israeli adoption agencies have said so in so many words. You know, it is the Russians setting the rules on this. They're the ones with the children. We are the demandeurs. And the only way that we're going to get around this is to find another country which is prepared to allow Israeli same-sex couples to adopt their children. I gather that there are talks currently underway with Colombia.
Daniela, is there likely to be a significant backlash in Israel against Israel's acquiescence in this? Is it a big deal?
Well, I mean, Israel is already under attack for what people call pinkwashing, the idea that it trumpets its LGBT rights and the idea of pride as a way to cover up the iniquities of the occupation and so on. Israelis are used to dealing with working within the system, whether it's the fact that you can't get buses on the Sabbath or the fact that Jerusalem Pride is not quite as fun an event as Tel Aviv Pride. I think for next weekend, they're just going to be getting on with partying.
I guess just a final thought on this, John, and to extrapolate a general premise from it. Is there anything to be gained in using issues like this to try and drag countries a few feet closer towards the light where human rights issues are concerned or not?
It's a nice thought, and I can think of examples where it might work. I don't think that Putin's Russia is where I'd start the experiment.
John Everard and Daniela Peled, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's episode. It was produced by Ben Ryland. The researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Charlton. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next at 1900. It's our design show, Section D, and there'll be more on the day's main stories with Emma Nelson on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.